Okay, we might get started on this session. Session being presented by Adrian Corbell regarding how seismic activity changes the natural landscape, and having been involved in some reserving exercises post Christchurch earthquakes, certainly has changed my own personal landscape. Adrian started his career with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia as a graduate before joining CommInsure's actuarial team on a personal lines pricing as a personal lines pricing analyst. He then joined KPMG, where his key responsibilities were piecing together HIH's reinsurance arrangements post-insolvency, conducting actuarial reserve reviews, and researching market developments in personal lines insurance and reinsurance. After working as an actuarial manager insurance runoff in London for 2 years with KPMG, he joined Munich Re in Munich as their business runoff actuary, where he developed exit solutions, portfolio valuations, and negotiated settlements with clients from the US, UK, and continental Europe. Adrian now leads the actuarial reserving for reinsurance liabilities in Munich Re Australasia. He's an FIA, member of IAA's Flood Working Committee in 2001, keen skier and traveller, and is recently undertaking his most exciting challenge to date, which is fatherhood. Thanks, Adrian.
Okay, thanks for that introduction. So I'll just start off with asking the audience, have any of you actually experienced a large earthquake? Yes? Whereabouts, may I ask? Wellington. Okay, so you're over there for that. So is anyone else? Actually, Australia's actually a very lucky country in that regard, in that we're not on any major fault lines, and we don't really have that much in the way of earthquake activity, especially when you compare it to some other countries like Japan, for example. Now, seismic risk is a significant risk to much of the world's population. And to list just a few recent examples of major seismic events, we've got the Tohoku Japanese earthquake, Christchurch, Turkey, Sichuan, the Pacific tsunami, large earthquake in northern Pakistan, recent earthquakes in northern Italy, and the Chile earthquake. So it's a major risk to a lot of the world. So before I move on to the slides, because I know you're all keen to look at the slides, just imagine for a moment that this room is a country. And we've just had a 7-magnitude earthquake. So let's say over here, Gloria, can you stand up? So the earthquake's hit here. That's the epicenter of the earthquake. Now, all you people a couple of metres away from Gloria, you would have felt the full impact of that earthquake. So sorry about that. And all you people up to, say, 10 metres from Gloria, so talking about this whole segment here, you would have felt the tremors as well. So once this event has happened and we've assessed the damage, we've worked out, you know, what we think the cost is going to be and made sure everyone's safe, what happens now? So I'm going to ask you two questions. Firstly, how do the rest of you feel? Are the people over there feeling a bit nervous? You know, there could be some more activity over there. You've just felt a really, really bad earthquake. People over this side of the room, other side of the country, you're probably feeling pretty safe. Like, quite lucky it didn't happen to us. Terrible for these people, obviously, and we want to look after them. But, okay, so we'll explore that a bit later. And the second point is, as actuaries, why are we here? What should we be thinking about once this event has occurred? Okay, before we go straight into the actuarial things, I want to go over a few of the basics of seismology. So for a lot of you, you may know a lot of this stuff. Hopefully you learn a little bit along the way. And it'll help us answer these other questions that we have. So let's begin. What is seismic activity? Anyone? Throw things at me. Come on. Earthshaking. Okay, it's a good start. So the definition we use is that it's any movement in the earth leading to a release of energy. That's a key point. We'll come back to that later. So that can be via either an earthquake, a tremor, a volcanic eruption, etc. Now, it's important to note that each event is slightly unique, so some earthquakes can be very similar. So they're unique. Why are they unique? Because the Earth's crust is always moving. It's constantly moving and changing. But probably more importantly, the interaction on the surface, the human aspect, is changing. So the way we use the land, what we're doing upstairs on the ground is changing over time. So that means the impact of every earthquake is different. So once an earthquake happens, what are going to be the key risks to humans? Anyone? What do you think the key risk is when an earthquake occurs? Building falling. Okay, good one. Yes, so man-made structures collapsing, igniting, or critical infrastructure failing are going to be the key risks. Also, there are secondary events that can occur after an earthquake. So we're talking about things like tsunamis, landslides, fires can occur, floods can occur, and of course there can be aftershocks, so additional earthquakes. All right, so let's look at the actual risk factors, what goes into an earthquake happening and the things that might concern us when we're looking at a risk model for seismic activity. Go to the slides. Actuaries love slides. Okay. So, first of all, that's a cool picture. I like this picture. This picture is actually all the earthquakes of magnitude 4 or over from 1898 to 2003. So the more severe earthquakes are glowing more than the less severe ones. So 9 will be like jumping out and burning your eyes in that picture. Okay, so the first risk factor, previous seismic activity. One of the best predictors of the future seismic activity is actually the past experience. So here you can see all the major activity along the Pacific Rim, Pacific Fault Line, and around the Ring of Fire in the Pacific. Highly seismic areas are generally much more likely to show this behaviour into the future. Now, we'll point out one exception in recent times is Christchurch. So this was actually on a fault line which was deemed to be an old fault line, so we didn't really know that much about it. Now, that's really a flaw in our historical records. So Australia and New Zealand, obviously not colonised too long ago, only a couple of hundred years, which geologically speaking, not very long. And we hadn't really seen much activity in these fault lines over that period of time. So when the earthquakes hit Christchurch, we didn't actually expect so much these fault lines would be highly active. Okay, next slide is actually the world's volcanoes. So if we look at that and the last slide, you see they pretty much overlap on all the fault lines. So a lot of seismic activity can occur from volcanoes and, enough said, I think. All right, the next risk factor is the amount of energy. Now, the amount of energy that's released from the Earth affects the magnitude of the event. So how do we measure the magnitude of an earthquake? Anyone know the answer to that? Amount of energy release. Good answer. Most people might have said Richter scale. So the Richter scale is the old measurement, which is still commonly used in the media. That's actually measuring the wavelength of the shocks coming out of the earthquake. It doesn't work too well on the high magnitude earthquakes, so above about 8.3. And we use a scale called the moment magnitude scale. This is what scientists use. And that is based on the amount of energy released. So full marks over there. Okay, there's actually a law called the Gutenberg-Richter law, which has a scientific relationship between the frequency and the magnitude of the earthquakes. Now, that's the scientific equation up there, n equals 10 to the a minus bm, where m is the magnitude and n is the kind of number of earthquakes expected. So basically with this, the a and the b vary by a different fault line and region, and generally speaking, the b is 1. So what that means is, or 1 or close to 1. So what that means is if you've got an expected 10, 7 magnitudes, you might get 1, 8. 10 eighths, you might get 1.9. That's roughly speaking how it works. Now, this law's pretty well accepted in the scientific community and holds pretty true. The constants do vary by region. Okay, next risk factor. So it's kind of two in here. Depth and location. So I'll talk about depth first. earthquakes can actually occur up to 700 kilometres below the surface. Now, the depth is really important when it comes to measuring the amount of damage that occurs on the surface. The deeper it is, the more the waves need to travel to get to the surface, which means more energy is absorbed along the way, so less shaking on the surface. Now, Christchurch, the example given on the left there, it was only 5 kilometres deep, the earthquake. So that was one of the key factors in the amount of surface intensity from the earthquake. So that meant that the earthquake was a lot more intense than it otherwise would have been. Another key factor in Christchurch was actually the location of it. So if you see that there's these mountains to the west and south, so people looking outside over here, what actually happened in this earthquake was the initial waves went out from the earthquake, came across to this mountain, and then reflected back. So that meant you had initial waves coming up and the ones reflecting back, and they superimposed, which meant that the waves were actually much stronger and larger than they would have otherwise been. Okay, the location is also very important to a lot of the other factors, the secondary events. So coastal areas are going to be much more prone to tsunami risk. So a good example for that is Japan. Japan, there's a lot of low-lying coastal cities close to the water, and the fault line is out in the water as well. Other areas such as Chile, where people live at high altitude, obviously not going to get hit by tsunami so much. Okay, I'm not going to go through the wave types in great detail, but basically there are 4 wave types that come out of a seismic event. The first one is the P waves, which are fast-moving compression waves. The second lot are the secondary waves, called S waves. Now, these actually move perpendicular direction to the P waves. So if it's going that way, they'll come out this way. And the other 2 waves, which are the ones that cause all the damage on the surface, pretty much, are the Love waves. So nothing romantic in that. It's actually named after a scientist called Love. Love waves are horizontal movements along the surface. And Rayleigh waves are the other ones, which are vertical movements, so up and down movements on the surface. Now, the magnitude and direction of these waves can impact the damage on the surface. And the vertical and horizontal movements can also have different effects on different soil types. And in some instances can lead to liquefaction. So liquefaction and soil types is the next risk factor. Okay, solid rock is less prone to seismic damage than artificially filled ground, swamps and soils. So this is a statement that's actually been proven pretty true. It was discovered when they looked into this San Francisco Great Earthquake. So the US geologists did a lot of study. And the areas that were built on solid rock had a lot less damage because a lot more of the shock waves were absorbed by that. So compact soils, they absorb a lot more of the energy, and that decreases the amplitudes of the waves and causes less vibrations on the surface. Now, softer soils also have the potential for liquefaction, and that's what you see up here in Niigata in Japan in 1964. So liquefaction, I'll talk about that now. Does anyone know what liquefaction is? It's probably a hot topic since Christchurch. So the actual definition of liquefaction, it's a hard word to say, is where through saturation with water, intense shaking and pressure, so that's the key thing for earthquakes, soils can take on the properties of liquids and lose their strength and the ability to support buildings and structures. So that's exactly what we're seeing here in Niigata to these apartment buildings. Now, liquefaction can permanently alter localized areas, and it can seriously damage the foundations of buildings and also underground structures. So underground structures, I'm talking about sewage pipes, gas pipes, cables, all that sort of stuff, all the underground infrastructure that modern cities have. Now, engineering solutions can actually reduce the amount of problems caused with liquefaction if it's a known area of risk. And post an event, engineers can repair liquefaction damage, though it's highly expensive. So it's better to prevent rather than cure. So a couple of good examples of where liquefaction has occurred in recent times. Niigata, which you're seeing on there, 1964, so not quite so recent, but also the Kobe earthquakes in Japan, and of course Christchurch. Okay, so they're the key risk factors that we're going to want to look at from modelling earthquakes from a scientific point of view. Now that we know that, let's have a look at some of the insurance and reinsurance aspects that we might want to think about. Okay, firstly, before we go on to the bullet points, I guess recent times have shown that the world's economies are actually really, really interconnected. What that means is a large event that occurs on the other side of the world can affect us. So good examples of that, the Japan earthquake and tsunami and Fukushima incident, and the Bangkok floods as well, where you had business interruption claims, kind of shockwaves across the world before that. So this is something to keep in mind with any large event anywhere in the world these days, as well as earthquakes, obviously. So what other things are we going to need to think about with earthquakes? Well, firstly, the amount of risk coverage in our portfolio and the amount of insurance that we have in place. Do we have enough? Do we need to get some more? And how much is our portfolio going to be exposed? Do we write lots of home and contents insurance over there where Gloria had her earthquake? Or are we covering this side? Or are we totally not involved in any lines of business that may be affected? Also, in some countries, you have to look at the insurance penetration. Home and contents insurance may not be so popular in Southeast Asia, for example, which are areas of high seismicity. There could be underinsurance, so people may not have insured to the full level that they need. Also, there could be seismic exclusions. California is a great example of this, where to get earthquake insurance on your home and contents, you actually pay additional. So you can buy home and contents insurance without this coverage, or you can pay a bit more and get it. So you'll want to look at any exclusions that are there, and also the particular local government. What's going on there? Are there any policies? Are there any schemes that are in place? New Zealand has the Earthquake Commission, for example. It really depends where you're looking at. So the next thing, the building vulnerability. In different areas, they have different building standards. So in Japan, you have to build high-rises. They have to meet a certain standard because they know there's a lot of seismic activity. In Sydney, I'm not sure what the rules are with that, but I'd imagine it's not nearly as stringent as with Japan, for example. Okay, that's also going to affect the cost of rebuilding. So it'll tell you how much, what's the likelihood of the buildings collapsing to start with, but then also how much you have to pay to repair buildings. Next thing, other insurance classes. So When an event happens, you immediately think, okay, the buildings fell down, we're covering the buildings, the people injured, and so forth. There's also other business classes that will be affected. Business interruption, you may have workers' compensation. There may be some liability. Who knows? Okay, the cost of repairs and rebuilding as well. So there can be a lot of factors in this. So the type of structures that you're actually insuring, the cost of labour in the region, the building materials, the building standards, if you need to have any temporary accommodation because there's been a large event occurring, so Christchurch is a good example for that. They had to bring in the workers and the temporary accommodation costs are quite high. Also land remediation, so if liquefaction occurs, you may need to develop engineering solutions, and that can be expensive. And as with any large event, there can be demand surges. So not enough builders, prices go up, or not enough materials, etc. And finally, I've talked about this a lot, and I'm going to talk about it some more later, secondary events. So what else may impact our portfolio afterwards with the aftershocks, the landslides, fires, floods, tsunamis? Okay. So that's the background, and these are the things that you would have wanted to have had built into your seismic risk model before an event happened. Now that we know the events happened, what can we expect to happen? Okay, before I go into the next slide, when a seismic event actually occurs, the risk factors for your future seismic activity should be reassessed to ensure not only that the models used reflect the most up-to-date information, but, as I'll show you later, the actual underlying seismic risk changes. Now, seismic activity is not limited to one single earthquake. So it's a bit different to cyclones or a bushfire, where you have a bushfire and then the area is burnt. Okay, you're not going to have a bushfire for a while. With seismic activity, you could have long periods. Let me say that again. So some regions have been shown in the past to have periods of high continued seismic activity and periods of low seismic activity. So what we could be seeing here is actually this area hasn't had much activity recently, but it's now entering a stage where it will have a lot of seismic activity. Also, this event could be a foreshock to something bigger. It might be a foreshock. It might be not. It's going to have aftershocks, but it might be a foreshock. So let me talk briefly about foreshocks. Foreshocks are generally just defined as a seismic movement that precedes a much larger one. We never actually know if an event is going to be a foreshock or not, and there's no scientific methodology or in place that can estimate this. So you don't actually know until the larger event has occurred that the first one was a foreshock. Now, what we do know is 70% of 7 or over magnitude earthquakes, around 70% or more, have had foreshock activity. So it's not just one big event. I mean, that can happen, one big event. Often there's a few minor tremors prior to that, and then the big one hits. Now, this is something we need to think about as actuaries. Like I said, it's actually really, really hard to quantify, and the scientists have no method to say, okay, here's the chance of this being a foreshock. But it's something that should be in the back of our minds, that yes, it could be a foreshock. Okay, the next thing is aftershocks. What's an aftershock? Well, it's a smaller magnitude earthquake following an event. Okay, they're responses to the stress changes from the initial fault movement. Now, it's important to note that seismicity generally increases significantly after an event. So whilst there could be no earthquakes for many, many years, you have a big earthquake, you can expect quite a few aftershocks after that. Now, aftershocks are lower magnitude, so I'll talk a bit more about that later and the effects that will have on the insurance portfolio. But there's actually a scientific law called the Omori Law, and the more used one is the modified one, which was updated a bit later than Omori, who was in the 60s. Now, what this graph actually shows is there's a relationship up here, Nt equals Kc plus t to the p. K is actually the initial shock size. So if it's a 7 on the Richter magnitude scale, K will be 7. And Nt is the number of aftershocks that we'll expect. So this is actually the decay pattern of an actual earthquake. So Northridge, California, 1994. Now, what this relationship shows is the frequency and the decay over time of the aftershocks. It doesn't show the severity. So if you have an 8 magnitude, it doesn't tell you what's the likelihood of a 7, what's the likelihood of a 6. It just says what would we expect a number of aftershocks in the near future. C and P in the equation are constants, and T is time. Okay, so aftershocks. We've had an event over here. Where are the aftershocks likely to happen in the near future? Well, actually, the areas affected by aftershocks, it's really, really large after the first shock, but it does reduce over time. So this is from a scientific paper by DeRubis, Loito, Petronero and Tossi, some Italian guys, I assume. This shows the aftershock impact zone and the distance after the event. So what you'll see down this bottom area is actually up to 10 days after the event, they've said, well, actually, we can experience aftershocks up to 2,000 kilometres from the epicenter. Now, this reduces quite dramatically over time. As you'll see, it looks linear, but it's a log-log scale, so it actually does reduce quite quickly. After 100 days, that region reduces to about 600 kilometres, and after 1,000 days, 150 kilometres, so it's getting much more localised. Having said that, if you do look at what's happened down here, most of the aftershocks are seen within a closer vicinity than the 2,000 kilometres. So it is more likely that it's closer to the epicentre, but it doesn't have to be. Now, aftershocks, how much of an impact can it have to the insurance portfolio? Actually, it depends. Typical actuarial answer, it depends. Most of the damage that's done in on the surface is done by the larger seismic shock. However, having said that, continued shaking of the earth can further weaken already damaged structures and cause collapses. Also, continued shaking and aftershocks can have psychological effects on the inhabitants of the city, and it can lead to further disruption in business, so business interruption claims. Also, if the initial event has actually not hit the city, so it's occurred outside the city in a paddock somewhere and not really done that much damage, what happens if an aid event happened out there and you just felt a little bit of a tremor in the city, but then a month later you feel a 7 right in the middle of the city? It's going to cause a lot of damage. So aftershocks can be something to be concerned about. And that's something we need to think about as actuaries. Okay, before I go on to that picture, because you're going to be mesmerised by the colours. Okay, in the past, what scientists believed was that once a major seismic event happened along a fault line, the fault would then remain dormant for quite some time, until enough stress built up for another event to occur. Now, quite recent studies have shown, and this is recent, I'm talking about the last 15, 20 years, that when stress is actually released from a seismic event, it doesn't disappear. It actually changes the stress up and down the fault line. Now, this is called Coulomb stress testing. I've got a couple of examples here. This is the Turkish earthquake in 1939. So what you see is the white line right in the middle here. Let's see if I can get the laser on it. Is the 1939 earthquake. Now, the stresses around this, so purple is less stress after the event, red is more stress after the event. So you see that from the event, okay, big region had less stress. But there are regions out here and out here where stress is increased, meaning more chance of seismic event than prior to the actual earthquake. Now, what happened subsequently was there was another earthquake up here, right in this stress level. Next one, Japan, Tohoku earthquake. So happened out here where this nice star is, the yellow star. All around there, decreases in blue, decreases in the Coulomb stresses. However, other regions down here, around Tokyo, might be something to worry about. There's an increase in stress on the fault line. So that means if you're looking at a Tokyo portfolio, your seismic risk has actually just increased, even though an earthquake's occurred. Now, scientists, seismologists, geologists calculate the stress changes along and near the fault lines to give us these sort of maps and determine which areas are more at risk in the future. Okay, secondary events. Firstly, talk about tsunamis, because that's a hot topic at the moment. Tsunamis are large ocean waves which can be generated by underwater seismic events. They occur immediately after the event and affect coastal areas, offshore facilities and shipping. Good examples are the Indian Ocean earthquake 2004 and, of course, Japan, which you see down there. Fires up here. How do fires occur from earthquakes? Well, earthquakes can damage gas pipes, power cables, electrical equipment, and can start fires in cities. Now, fires can actually be more damaging than the earthquake. So if you have lots and lots of fires in a city, and you have damage to the water systems, so fire hydrants and things like that, the infrastructure used to fight the fire, fires can burn out of control. Now, a good example of this was in 1906, the San Francisco earthquake led to the city actually being on fire for 3 days, and the fires did a lot more damage than the actual earthquake. Now, changes to topography can actually lead to landslides. You can see that in La Conchita. Earthquake activities caused a landslide. Can also lead to flooding from the event or after future heavy rainfall. And flooding can also be an issue if there's damage to critical man-made hydrological structures, so dams, levees, dikes, or flood barriers. Now, I've given an example here of the Three Gorges Dam, a modern marvel in engineering in China. It's actually built near an active fault line. So you can see that if there was a big seismic event occurring here, whether it ruptures the dam or not, it may actually allow another course for the water to go. And just think of the impact that could occur if something like that happened. Okay, so that's all the scientific side and a couple of the insurance aspects to think about. Actuarial considerations. Go back to the two questions I asked you earlier. What shall we be thinking about as actuaries after this event has occurred over on this side of the room, this part of the country? And how are the rest of you now feeling? You know, aftershocks can hit up to 2,000 kilometres away. People over here might not be feeling so safe anymore. People over here may be even more worried. So, sorry. A bit trigger happy there. So I'll start with pricing. After an event, we need to look at the assumptions underlying our seismic risk model. Was the event actually included as a possible scenario? Do we need to look again at the return periods on such an event happening? We may have new knowledge from the event. We may have looked more into the soil types, liquefaction. We need to consider these things in future pricing. Also, what are the reinsurance implications? Do we have enough coverage for our future policies? Now, it's also possible that the damage has already been done. So all the buildings in this region that are likely to fall over from seismic activity have something to consider. Sorry, I'll just put this away for now. Okay, outstanding claims. Claims may emerge over a long period. So there can be supply constraints in the assessors, the labour and the building materials. Now, aftershocks can delay the rebuilding. So Christchurch was a good example of that. Continued aftershocks, okay, we won't rebuild yet. Now, there can be event-specific aspects as well. So the change in the building standards that have been proposed in New Zealand is a good example of that. Once the event happened, the government reassesses and the landscape changes. Now, the government response can also affect us. So it may reduce our outstanding claims if they're assisting with claim payments or that they can gain some sort of efficiency in processing the claims and the disputes. And it's also worth thinking about the claims handling expense as an actuary. So we may need to bring on additional staff at short notice. We may have project costs involved in managing this large claim, and there may be overtime costs. Okay, premium liabilities. Once the event occurs, like I've said before, and with the Coulomb changes, the unexpired portion of the insurance or reinsurance risks changes. So this event could be a foreshock. We could have aftershocks that are going to hit our major cities. The Coulomb stress changes may actually say there's an increased chance of an aftershock right over here where you're sitting. So You need to consider this, and you need to also consider the amount of claims already. Have properties been destroyed already, or have they just been partially damaged and future activity may destroy them? And what's going to go on with the reinsurance? How has our reinsurance changed? Do we still have enough limits and coverage in place? Okay, risk margins. After the event, the volatility in our outstanding claims and our premium liabilities is going to change. Sorry, I'll speed up. The risk margin should reflect the potential volatility due to the demand spikes, event-specific aspects, and the uncertainty in the estimate of the reserves, and potential future seismic activity. And also, we need to think about the reinsurance issues, such as the amount of coverage. So just to conclude, each seismic event can be somewhat unique and can lead to further local activity. To ensure the risks are correctly priced and reserved, the assumption used in the seismic and actuarial models need to be revisited after an event. Actuaries then need to consider both the short and long-term effects of the event. Now, this area is a challenge for actuaries who should ideally utilise available expertise, so that can be geophysicists, seismologists, geologists, but also underwriting and claims when you're building your model and informing your opinion. So before I finish, I'll just end with, as an insurer, what should you do? Well, reassess your model, okay? Reassess your reinsurance arrangements, perhaps change your factors in your model for the future seismic events. And if you don't have the expertise I just spoke about, so the seismologists, the geophysicists, talk to your reinsurer. Okay.
Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks. And if we've got any time for questions?
We've got 1 minute for a question, a couple of quick questions.
Didn't expect to go for so long.
Any questions? If you do have a question, please state your name and company.
Can't hear you.
Hugh Miller, Taylor Fry. Okay, that's better. Just a question on the science. Do you think the science will ever get good enough that it can reliably predict earthquakes? So a quake will happen this year in this region?
We've been trying for a while. I think the Coulomb stress changes are a good advancement in it, but we're a long way from predicting earthquakes. A long, long way. So in the foreseeable future, no.
Just a comment, really. Yusuf Kagan from Suncorp.
Yep.
Just listen to what you're saying. I guess if you wait for an earthquake before you decide to change your limit or something, it might be very expensive.
Yes.
So what the stuff that you're saying, basically what it implies is that you should maybe think about that second aftershock and whether, your building stock, which is now more vulnerable, and whether your reinsurance structure up front needs to be structured in such a way that second event is sort of taken into account, and whether you want a higher limit or some other sort of structure for that.
That's right. I mean, there's the initial. So you may have modelled, say, an event occurring in Sydney or in Christchurch, but you have to think about these other factors that can occur when a seismic event occurs. And yes, as you said, pricing may change after an event. So Christchurch is a good example when everyone looked at their risk models and said, actually, we hadn't allowed for this and the potential there. So reinsurance got a lot more expensive and coverage gets more expensive. So the sooner you can think about it, I think the better. And the amount of changes that you can get away with in pricing is also going to be dependent on the market factors, not just the technical pricing that you're coming up with from your models.
Tim Clark from IAG. Just curious, Adrian, has there ever been an earthquake where the reinsurers haven't changed their underlying assumption on the pricing?
Well, actually, the Tohoku earthquake, a lot of the Japanese earthquakes, they're modelled risks I can speak for Munich Re anyway. If it's a model risk, then, okay, we're not actually changing our underlying assumptions. We may relook at that, and like I said, you need to relook at the return periods and things like that, and the future risk and how that's changed. However, if it fits in with our expectation in the model, then yeah, you don't need to change it. Now, whether that's negotiated or not is another matter. But the actual model, if it fits in with the model, then the assumptions wouldn't change. No.
Okay, we might wrap up there. And just thank Adrian again for a very interesting presentation.
Thanks.